Good morning, Willowdale. How are you this morning? Well, I'm going to get started with before our message, telling you some mostly good news. All right, so here's the mostly good news. You may know our women's ministry director, Diane Eland, as she has been leading out our women's ministry as like a halftime employee for us. She's also been leading out with CBS Community Bible Study. She's been an area leader for them. Well, they have offered her a regional director position, and she is taking that. She's moving from four areas to four states in her leadership, which in my mind is a tremendous net gain for the kingdom of God, but it's a net gain in that it's a little bit of a loss for us. I know Carol and I have worked closely with her, and she's just been a tremendous friend and coworker and leader among us. And so she and her husband, Ken, they're still part of our church, and they're significant contributors like in all the things that they do. And I'm sure they will continue to make that kind of impact around here. But we'll lose that a little bit. And it's going to give us an opportunity to just kind of look at women's ministry and see what it looks like for that to take its next step forward. So, women, you heard from Diane by email on Friday, and we'll be letting you know some opportunities for you to weigh in and kind of, be a part of the conversation as far as what's next. So what I want to do now is I want to start out our message this morning with a basic question. Here's a question. It's the simplest of all questions. Why? Why do you do what you do? I'm going to suggest this morning that why you do what you do will shape almost all of the what's in your life. It'll shape the how's, it'll shape the what's. Why you do what you do will shape in so many ways what your life looks like and how you feel about it. All right? I like to introduce you to a gentleman named Michael Melamed. He is a marathon runner. He has run the Berlin Marathon, the Chicago Marathon, the New York Marathon, and the Boston Marathon. What's notable about him is that recently when he ran the Boston Marathon, he completed the marathon at 4 o'clock in the morning. 20 hours after the race began, the timer had been broken down. The crowds had gone away. The cones had been taken up. There was traffic back out on the roads when he came in and completed his marathon. What's notable about him as a runner is that he suffers from a muscular condition similar to muscular dystrophy. But he's committed to running and finishing these races. And he has a quote that I found to be quite powerful. This is what he says. He says, in any marathon, you have to know why you're doing it. Because in the last mile, the marathon will ask you. I think that's probably true about marathons. The marathon would probably ask me at around mile 5. But it's true also about life. Life will test you. Your faith will be tested. Your relationships will be tested. Your family will be tested. And you need to know the why, because you need to understand and know the difference between what might be a dead end and what just is the 25th mile and it hurts. You need to know why you're not getting off at the nearest exit ramp. You need to know why you're hanging in there and lasting a little bit longer. You need to know the why, because it will ultimately shape the what's and the how's. We're in a series called Stick. We are studying this tremendous passage in the Gospel of John where Jesus describes himself as the true vine, the vine that fills the earth with beauty and fruitfulness. The Father is the gardener, And we are branches in that vine. And as we remain in that vine and he remains in us, we become fruitful people. And he talks about what that looks like. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to read this passage and get back to our question. So feel free to read along with me from John chapter 15. This is Jesus teaching. He says, "I'm the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I'm the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you may go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command: love each other." All right, so you might have been thinking, they're like, all right, where's he getting this why question out of this passage? And the question actually isn't in the passage, but the answer is there in verse 8, where Jesus says, "It is to my Father's glory, this is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples." What this whole idea of being in the vine is about, it's about the Father's glory. And if you're about that, everything works itself out. And I would suggest that getting our why right, it determines everything. Let me see if I can use a basic, simple example of this. When I was in seminary, I used to work on a 40-acre farm. And Kathleen and I, we had this studio apartment of above a barn. It was cool. We lived there. And I worked there over the summers, and I would work there throughout the school year. And I had 3 different tractors, 2 different chainsaws. I mean, it was a lot of fun. I loved it. And we had a pickup truck, and I used the pickup truck from time to time because we had one car. It was great. So now, a lot of times I'd spend a lot of time on a tractor, and while I was on the tractor, you're just looking around, checking things out, and there's this particular tree that I always liked. I liked the way it was shaped, and I liked its flower, and it was right on the corner of a wooded section, and I was going by the tree one time, and I looked at it, and I looked down at the base, and I saw that there's this vine wrapped around it. So I got my hand axe out, because you keep your hand axe handy when you have an awesome job like that. So, and I literally cut a slice out of the vine because I was like, well, I got to stop this thing. And I just kind of moved on, didn't think much about it. And about 3 weeks later, I'm on the other side of the field, and I look at the tree, and I was surprised to see that the tree was dead. I was shocked. The tree was dead. Actually, there's one part of the tree that was still alive. There's one branch still kind of hanging on. But I was shocked. And as I got closer, I realized that this tree that I admired, I thought had a great shape and was had a nice flower and was attractive, I wasn't actually looking at the tree. The vine, this nasty vine, had wrapped itself around the tree, choked the life out of the tree, and was using the tree as a trellis for its own expansion. And I found that to be particularly challenging to me. Because in any kind of community such as ours that's well-educated and well-heeled, there's always going to be enough resources that we can invest ourselves in all sorts of things that can make us look good on the outside, admired from the outside. But any one of these things could choke our spiritual life and use us as a trellis for its own expansion, right? There's endless ways we can use our children to look good and feel good about ourselves. There's endless ways we can invest ourselves in our vocation to make ourselves look admirable, our volunteer efforts. There's all sorts of things that are good that can make us look good to others and maybe even make us look good to ourselves, and we can begin believing the press clippings, and we could feel good about what's presented out there, but that thing that really owns us is the vine that's choking our spiritual life to death. Getting our why right protects us from anything that would be a good thing out there, even an admirable thing out there, but that might end up seeking to control us as it makes us look very good. Getting our why right protects us from getting the wrong what's and the wrong hows. But I got a problem. I gave you the question, right? You know, the why, right? Why do you do what you do? But here's the answer I gave you. The Father's glory. That's an awful word. I mean, we remember Charlie Brown's teacher, right? Wah, 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 wah. I mean, we use the word glory and we'll sing about it. Or we might even say like that slice of pie was just glorious. I mean, the word's got the semantic range the size of Atlantic Ocean. It really means nothing. It has about as much meaning as a hyphen, right? And so when I say, all right, the answer to the question why is the Father's glory, well, what does that mean? It just feels so abstract and meaningless. Now, to the ancients, it wasn't that. It was actually the ancients, when they would think of the word glory, they actually had something very visual in their mind's eye. Because the stories of how the Israelites were established and launched in the beginning, they had a very specific idea around glory. In fact, if you read the book of Exodus, much of it is around this very visual thing known as the glory of God. Just like we as Americans, we've got our stories and we have a mind's eye as to what Valley Forge was like or Bunker Hill was like. The Israelites have that around the glory of God. Think about it. Right after the Israelites came into the desert, they're on the other side of the Red Sea, provisions starting getting low, and the Israelites were going to Aaron and Moses like, look, what's going on around here? When we were in Egypt, we ordered pizza on the weekends. We had steak every night. Things were great. And now, what are we going to eat? It's not good anymore. What are we going to do? And Moses and Aaron, we're trying to come out. Look, God's going to provide for us. Don't worry. God's got a good plan. He's going to provide for us. And as Moses and Aaron are talking, and they're in the desert, right? This cloud shows up on the horizon. And you're in the desert, so there's no clouds, right? But this cloud shows up on the horizon. It's notable. Everyone notices it. And the cloud starts coming towards them. And it's a cloud, but it's not like a cloud because it's not your typical rain cloud. This is the cloud of the presence of the glory of God. And it's coming to be among them. And what you'll see throughout the book of the Exodus as they're wandering through the desert here, this cloud is always with them. And in fact, the cloud begins to lead them. And when the cloud moves, the people move. And the cloud led them to Sinai, Mount Sinai, where Moses went up to get the law. But when they got there, the cloud turned dark. It got very dark out there. There was thunder. There was lightning. Everybody was freaked out. Nobody wanted to get near that mountain because they knew the presence of God was on that mountain, and it was intimidating. The cloud was scary, But it was almost, it would almost be scary if the cloud wasn't there. It was the presence of God among them. And they knew it as the glory cloud, or as the older translations would call it, the Shekinah glory. So Moses, once things calm down on the mountain, Moses goes up. And when he gets up to the top of the mountain, he's in this cloud and God is speaking to him. He can't actually see God, but God is revealing himself to Moses. And Moses gets the vision as to what the people of Israel are supposed to be. And particularly he gets this vision of what a tabernacle ought to be. So he goes down the mountain. He says, okay, here are the commands. This is the vision. This is the kind of people we ought to be. And God's going to dwell among us in this tabernacle. It's going to be a tent thing because we're going to be moving in the desert. And so this tent tabernacle gets built and put together. And as they're finishing this thing up and they're establishing this thing, that cloud that was there all of a sudden just goes in and fills the tabernacle. And Moses is there and they got to get out of it. They got to get out of there. It fills it up. And they know at that point that the glory of God is now residing in this tabernacle among them. And now the tabernacle in and of itself becomes representative of the presence of God among them. All right. So the tabernacle's moved around. They end up bringing it into Israel, but you don't really hear much about the glory cloud for like 500 years. I mean, they knew about it. They know the story. I mean, these are the stories that nurtured them as children. But it wasn't until 500 years later, and Solomon, King Solomon's finally building the temple. It's the permanent version of the tabernacle. He's building the temple, and the priests are doing their sacrifice, and they're doing their work there, and they got this thing done. They had this big celebration. And all of a sudden, that cloud shows up again, and it fills the temple, and the priests are freaked out. They have to run and get out of there. Why? Because the presence of God is among them. They can't really work because it's this cloud, but it's thick. They don't know what it is, but they know it's real. And for this was a significant moment for the Israelites because they knew from that time on that God wasn't just with them because he told them about them back in the day, but now in this temple, God would be with them. Unfortunately, that really becomes the high moment of God's presence among the nation of Israel, because they lose the vision. They totally break the covenant. Eventually that temple is torn down. Another one gets built, but that wasn't very, very good. And then this guy, Herod, who doesn't love God at all, builds this other really kind of great temple that Jesus was around. But like, there's no glory cloud again. I mean, it was great that God had this visible cloud that everyone could have in their mind's eyes, but they don't have anything like it again, well, until Jesus comes. And our gospel writer, John, he helps them see that what God once did visibly, now he's going to do tangibly. All right, so as John is summarizing the arrival of Jesus into this world, he says this. He says, the word, the way God's always communicated himself, God's speaking and the way he's communicated to us, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. That word dwelling is literally a verb for tent. He built his tent. He set up his tabernacle. If you think about his word, like as if God had been sending us emails, right? If God had been sending us emails, his words, finally the person behind the email shows up in the person of Jesus, right? He you're not only just getting his emails, he shows up in the office. In fact, he sets up his office right next door. That which once was visible or we had words for him now is here among us. And it says, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. That which once was just visible through the cloud is now tangible in the person of Jesus. So that leads us to the next question. All right, so what is, you know, our passages to the, now this is to my Father's glory. Well, what is the glory of a father? What is the glory of the Father? And what you need to know is the passage is not saying, what's the glory of the Almighty? What's the glory of the Lord? No, specifically speaking, what's the glory of the Father? Well, what's the glory of any father? If someone's going to think about what it means to be a father, well, it's their children, right? What's the glory of the Father who has only one begotten Son? It's that one Son. The word glory ended up, because they didn't have like the cloud to talk about it, they end up using it as a verb and to glorify. They end up using it as an adjective to something is glorious. The idea of glory is literally the Hebrew word for kavod, kavod. It's something heavy. It's something weighty. It's something significant. And in the Hebrew mind, if you put God on a scale, he'd be more significant than anything else out there, right? Well, what would be glorious to God? The God the Father, what would be the most significant thing that he could ever put on the scale that mattered to him? It'd be his Son. His Son was his glory. All right, so I'm getting to that stage in life where my kids are starting to exceed the sum of that which is invested in them. They're starting to do things that we never would have taught them to do or never could have. They're just kind of going beyond us, right? My daughters are in musicals. My son's running 5K. He's a third grader. He's faster than me, all right? So, but here's the thing. It's awesome. It's awesome because in some way, as they expand, I expand. As they expand, it's sort of like an expansion to me. I don't run, but my daughter started running, so I started running. I ran a 10K with her yesterday. I would never choose to do that, really ever. I mean, I just have no interest. But I got to be with her, so she expands, I expand. They get into musicals. I was never into musicals. I had no musical talent. I had nothing. But some as they're getting into it, I get pulled into it. Their expansion becomes my expansion. In some ways, our children are something glorious to Kathleen and me. As they expand, I expand. And so for the Father, as Jesus expands, he expands. And what's Jesus' plan for the way he expands? He says, well, this is my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit. Well, who? His disciples. And he says, showing yourselves to be my disciples. He says, look, as you become like me, you're going to bear fruit like me. And as you bear fruit like me, you're going to expand. And as you expand, I expand. And as I expand, the Father expands. That's how it works. So you stay in the vine. As you stay in the vine, you bear fruit. You expand, I expand, the Father expands. That's how it works. And I'm my Father's glory. I am my Father's glory, and you know what? My Father's my glory. Everything I have is in my Father, and everything I am is for the Father. And if you're going to be like me, if you're going to be my disciples, it's going to be the same with you. It's going to be the same with you. That's just how it's going to work. All right, so as we expand, so to see, let's talk about it and just try to move this to be a little bit more practical. All right, so three basic ways as to kind of how this works. First, the glory of the Father is Jesus's why. It's Jesus's why, and it should be ours as well. See, Jesus had a decent marathon to run. He was going to be misunderstood. When he began his ministry, he went and he fasted for 40 days. He didn't eat for 40 days. He was severely tempted in that time. When he began his ministry, he was itinerant. He didn't have a home. He was going to have to trust that he had homes. He was going to invest into people who weren't going to understand him. They weren't going to get it. They weren't going to listen to him well. Those with power and influence were going to use their power and influence against him. Those with power and influence were going to seek his harm, to seek his death, to take the things he has built up and tear those things down. Those that he love and care for will not only abandon him, but they will also betray him. Everything good in this world would be taken away from him. And not only that, his life would be taken away. He would be abused. He would be tortured. And he'd go all the way to the cross. And he understood this. And he understood that there's going to be many questions on the 25th mile as to why he was doing this. His disciples weren't good enough. Being able to be a great teacher wasn't going to be good enough. The hope that he might be raised again wasn't going to be good enough. The only thing that was going to be sufficient for Jesus to finish his race rightly was the glory of the Father, his love and affection and his commitment to the Father. And I would suggest to you that there's no other why that can bear the weight of your humanity than the glory of the Father. You are made to glorify the Father. Everything else will disappoint you and ultimately control you. As good as it feels when our children expand, they need to separate. They need to move on. They are going to make mistakes. And they won't call as nearly as much as we want them to do. Right? It's just what's going to happen. That cannot bear the weight of our why. Our vocations, as powerful as they make us feel when we're out there doing something, will come to an end. There will be somebody better than us that will come along and they'll do the job better. The day is coming. We'll need to retire, move on, find something different. Even our volunteer efforts, they will be taken advantage of. They will come to an end as well. There is no other nasty vine that we can indulge ourselves or give ourselves to that can bear the weight of our humanity, bear the weight of that which we ought to give ourselves to, but the glory of God. So the natural question that comes out of this is like, all right, so I got to live for the glory of God. Does that mean I need to get rid of my TV and like give up on my vacation and go on a short-term mission trip? Is that like what you're saying? Is that what you're saying? Well, maybe. But it depends on where you start, right? I mean, is your vacation escape from your faith? Is your TV escape from reality? What I'm actually saying is let's step back. Let's step back and understand what it means. I think I've heard no better explanation of this by a pastor named John Piper, who says that God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. Where do you find your satisfaction in life? When your satisfaction, your contentment, your sense of wellness and wholeness and goodness is coming from all that God has given you, you take that into your workplace. You take that into your family life. You take that into your important relationships. You take that into your leisure. You take that into all of life. There's this dualistic idea that there's like spiritual things in this world and not so spiritual things. But if God created all things by his spirit, everything is spiritual. Leisure, work, family, ministry, vocation, all of those things count. And so what we do is we find our satisfaction in God, finding our satisfaction in God in all of the ventures we move into in life. If our true satisfaction is in God, rooted into the right nourishing roots, right? We don't have to worry about something coming around and choking us to death, right? The what's work themselves out as we get the right why into our life. And when we are satisfied by that right why, then God glorifies himself in our lives. Why? Because it ends up becoming quite natural because we're contented in what he's given us to do. We're contented in how he has brought our circumstances together. We rest in those things. We find joy in those things. And well, fruitfulness begins taking care of itself from there. God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. All right, second thing. The other thing you need to know about this is a missionary passage. Part of how we bear fruit is we connect other people into the vine. Other people begin hearing about Jesus and they want to be a part of it. And now I know I'm going to start freaking you guys out because it's kind of like, well, wait a second. That's going to make everybody upset if I start telling them about Jesus and, you know, there's a church and school thing. Like, well, what's that? How do I do that without, well, let me back us up a little bit and calm us down on this whole idea that we extend our faith to others. I want to go back to my life on the farm. I worked for a couple. A real sweet couple. They were like the New England types that were better than everybody else. and smarter than everybody else. And they were smart people. And there's one thing that could always get in their skin, get under their skin. And I actually quite enjoyed it when it happened. They had bought this farm. It was their vision for life. He was a workaholic. She was an alcoholic. And so they barely enjoyed the farm, but they were still better than everybody else around them. One of the things that always got under their skin was the blanked multiflora rose. All right. So blank is a four-letter word with an ED on the end. All right. So the blank multiflora rose. The multiflora rose was an idea. Wouldn't it be great if we had hedging that bloomed? It bloomed like roses, and it flowered our property like the beautiful garden we envision it to be. Wouldn't it be tremendous? And so they purchased lots of multiflora roses, and they planted them in strategic places around their property, and subsequently watched over the next several years the blanked multiflora rose take over and expand and grow everywhere, and they couldn't stop it. And they had thorns, and they were frustrating, and they killed other plants, and it just took over, and they became known as the blanked multiflora rose. And I mean, they had gone after this thing aggressively, but by the time I got there, they'd given up. The blanked multiflora rose had won. We tend to lose against nature in that way. You plant a tree next to a sidewalk, the tree will win. The sidewalk will lose. Nature tends to win. And what I would suggest, as you think about your faith, just know anything healthy is going to grow and multiply itself. Anything healthy will grow and multiply itself. We get so wrapped around the axle as to, hey, how do we talk to people about this? Here's the thing. Don't worry about other people. If you're satisfied in God and your life is bearing the kind of fruit that makes people want to be around you, you know what I mean? Love and joy and peace and patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. If that's happening in your life, you're going to talk about who God is. Why? Because it's quite natural. Why? You're satisfied in Him. And it might get awkward for somebody else, but that's their thing. It's not, what would be weird is if you're that person who talks about Him, but nobody wants to be around you, right? Who's doing all kinds of stuff out here, making it look good, but nobody really wants to be around you, but you have a lot to say. Nobody wants that. But if your why is right, the what's are happening in your life. And people are just going to want to be around you. You're going to be a source of joy to others. You're going to be a resource. People are going to consider you somebody who's growing in love. You're at least going to be authentic about what's true about your life. And as you're true about your life, you're going to be relatively humble because you fall far short of who you ought to be. But at least you're a humble person. And you're trying to be loving. You're trying to be kind. And when somebody else realizes that their vine has been hacked at the root and all of a sudden they've got this empty trellis of a life, they're going to come looking for somebody who's fruitful. And it's going to come up naturally and they're going to talk about it. And they ought to want what you have. Anything healthy grows and multiplies itself. When we get the why right, well, the what's take care of themselves. The what's will take care of themselves. Let me talk about a third part of this. Our lives will reflect the glory of the Father. As we're trying to think about how we glorify the Father, there's one key passage that comes up. And you know this passage, Jesus said famously, He said, "You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." So here's what Jesus is not saying. He's like, "You're the light of the world, so go do good deeds." He's not saying that. He's saying, hey, if you're connected to me, you're just going to start doing good deeds. It's just going to be what you do. You're going to do nice things for people. You're going to help people. Your life is going to be about making this world better. You are the light of the world. It's something that's already true of you. So let people see your good deeds And point to the Father. Allow the glorify the Father in what you do. It's just gonna happen. A team of researchers at the University of Sheffield in 2010 announced that they had found the brightest star in the universe. So if we want to think about light of the world, they found the brightest star in the universe. This star is actually 30 times the actual diameter and size of our sun. So if you look at a picture of it, there is aptly named R136A1, and right next to it is the sun. And actually, there is one pixel on display there representing the size of our sun compared to this, R136A1. Anyway, so I can see the little pixel. You probably can't see a pixel, but there really is a pixel there. And so this thing's 30 times the size, but when it comes to the actual mass, it's 265 times the actual mass of our sun. I have no idea where they get these measurements. They figure these things out. Anyway, so that's significant. But here's the thing. It's 10 million times brighter than our sun. I mean, just to think of something twice as bright as our sun is really kind of overwhelming. 10 times is beyond my imagination. 100 times? 1,000 times? Inconceivable really isn't a word that helps there. 1,000,000 times, forget about it. 10 million times brighter than our sun. I mean, what other planet could be even within the galaxy of a star like that? I mean, our minds cannot wrap our... I can't even start beginning to think about that kind of brightness. 10 million times brighter than our sun. I can't believe... It's so hard to believe that there's actually a brightness that bright. But it shows us that there are things more powerful and glorious and weighty than we can really even imagine. And it also points maybe to something else that's true about God. God lives in unapproachable light. No one has seen him, and no one can see him. See, when it comes to the glory of God, that cloud was God's way of getting close to his people while also protecting us from him. The cloud protected Moses from actually seeing God. Nobody could see him and live. The kind of glory that Jesus describes and understands of the Father is unapproachable for the rest of us. The cloud was so that the Israelites could have something visible that they could refer to when they think of the glory of God. When Jesus came, Jesus was the way God would veil himself in our own humanity. So that not only we'd have something visible to see, we'd actually have something tangible to talk about when it comes to the glory of God. But in many ways, it's beyond language still. When it comes to us, when God begins revealing himself through us, because it was always more than Jesus. It was always going to be about Jesus and his disciples and how the vine fills the earth through us. Not only is the glory of God visible, it's tangible, but now it's local. Everyone can experience the light of the world. Allow me to push my astrophysics beyond where I should. But I heard, I found out about a concept recently called albedo. Now, not libido, don't go there. I'm talking about albedo, all right? Here's what albedo is. It's the way a planet reflects light. And it's a ratio, okay? So Venus has a 0.65 albedo, which means 65% of the light that hits Venus is reflected out from it. That's why we can always see Venus when it's in our night sky, because it reflects an awful lot of light. Earth, on the other hand, has a 0.30 albedo, all right? So, which means that we reflect 30% of the light, but it's variable based upon climate and surface, right? So freshly poured asphalt has a 0.04 albedo. It just absorbs all the light into itself. It doesn't reflect much at all. On the strong contrast, freshly fallen snow, 0.8. 80% of the light, it reflects back. What's your albedo? The way we glorify the Father is through our albedo. It's the way we reflect God in this world. The way we are rooted into the vine, by having our why clearly established, will shape the what's in our lives. And as the what's in our lives get clear, we become the light of the world. We reflect more and more of who He is to others. And all the other stuff starts taking care of itself. What's your albedo? It's all based upon your why. Your why is shaping the what's in your life. And if your why is clear, you're going to be a reflection of God in all things. The alternative is to be like asphalt, just taking all the warmth and the goodness and all the light that God has given us in this world and just absorbing it into yourself. Do you absorb all the goodness? Are you a reflection of it? When our why is right, we are rooted into the vine, and all the goodness and life of the vine flows through our lives, enables us to not just receive goodness, but to be a reflection of it for others. And we bear fruit, because why? Anything healthy bears fruit. It multiplies. It grows. It's just what happens, right? We have one last thing we get to do now. I'm going to pray in just a moment. And after I pray, the band's going to just play some music, and it's going to give us an opportunity to pray, right? Our pastor talks about as we pray, as we remain in Him, we can ask whatever we wish of the Father, and it'll be given. We want to ask, we're doing this in Jennersville, Greg's over there today, and we're doing this here in Canada. We want to ask that as a body, we would pray glory prayers. We want to pray that the glory of God would be revealed in and through us. And so you're going to have a couple of minutes as they play softly to write out a prayer. You've got a purple card that's been handed out or is in the pocket in front of you. What's something in your life you want to see God glorified in? Something in your own life, something in your workplace, your neighbor, your community, something in where you live, something in our nation. Pray. Write out a glory prayer, and after the service, take it back to the trellis, a good trellis, out in the back there, and trade your prayer for a word from God, a passage of Scripture that describes the glory of God to us. Let me pray. Father, we thank You that You sent Jesus. He's a tangible picture of Your glory. And now You revealed Yourself in us, and now the glory of God is local as we can be the light of the world. God, would You show us Yourself that we might be fully satisfied in You, that You might be fully glorified in us. In Jesus' name we pray.